Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Robert Yeager and the Tau Foundation.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. People receive life-altering diagnoses every day. Today, we talk to parents and providers about children who've been diagnosed with diabetes. There are two kinds of diabetes, type 1, formerly known as juvenile diabetes, and type 2. Coming up, we'll hear from the local chapter of JDRF, the global organization dedicated to funding type 1 diabetes research. And we'll zoom in on Connecticut to learn about the disparities that exist in our communities. Data Haven will join us. We'll also talk to a doctor about the advances in treatment for diabetes. Now, this month marks the 100th anniversary of the discovery of insulin to treat diabetes. Today, it's one of the most expensive drugs, affecting millions of Americans. We'll also talk about recent changes in law, both in Connecticut and federally, to help diabetics. That's coming up. First, joining us are two Connecticut residents, a mother and daughter. Marie Snow joins us on Zoom. She's a resident of Killingworth. Marie, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy. Thanks for having me on.
And Marie is joined by her daughter, Olive, who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes this summer. Olive, thank you for coming on today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Now, I'll start with you, Marie. I had mentioned that Olive was first diagnosed with type 1 diabetes this summer. Can you talk about the events that led up to when you got that diagnosis?
Yeah, absolutely. So Olive, it was during the height of the pandemic where the kids were going to school remotely or half in school, half at home, and the kids were tired, and Olive was particularly tired, and she would look at herself in the mirror and comment on the dark circles under her eyes. And she would, she was losing weight, but eating a lot. And she was constantly tired and constantly drinking water. So in hindsight, these are the signs that, we should have known, but we didn't. We didn't know the signs for diabetes, but she was always thirsty. And then the week before her diagnosis, she got sick and was throwing up a ton of water and drinking a ton of water until she was so dehydrated we had to bring her to the emergency room. And that's where we got our diagnosis.
That must have been really scary to not know, you know, what's wrong with your child. And so when you went to the emergency room, how soon before they told you that that Olive may have type 1 diabetes?
It was almost immediate because they checked her urine and found extremely high levels of sugar. So they immediately detected something was wrong. We were in denial for a while until it really hit us that this was the case.
That's a lot to process at the time. And when we talk about type 1 diabetes, that's when the pancreas stops producing insulin. And so people with type 1 diabetes must constantly monitor blood sugar levels, either inject or infuse insulin through a pump, and then carefully balance insulin doses with eating and activity throughout the day. And so when you got that diagnosis for Olive and thinking about what this means for her and the family, like how do you get used to that change in routine? What went through your mind when the doctors told you about steps to treat her?
I don't know. I can't remember what was going through my mind at the time, other than, oh my gosh, our life is going to change forever. It was only until recently that we're realizing how diabetes can just be something that's there, you know, in the background and not constantly in the forefront of our lives. But for a while it was taking over everything. And I thought I would have to change so many things, but in reality, you adapt and you find ways to, you find your new normal. And this is the expression that all the people around us kept saying, you know, you'll find your new normal. And we are.
Again, you're hearing Marie Snow. She's a resident of Killingworth. Her daughter, Olive, was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes this summer. We're talking about diabetes in children and young people. You can join us, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Olive is sitting right next to you. Olive, can you tell us about that time when you had to go to the hospital and when you were told you had diabetes? Tell us how you and your family processed this. And, you know, how this has changed your life.
Well, I was, before I had to have insulin injections, which was really hard for me. The first time I had it, I wasn't really comfortable getting the shots and I didn't know what was going on. And then I was able to go on the trial and I got a CGM and I got a pump and everything was great.
So you mentioned this trial. So Marie, fill in that story for us. So the pump that Olive uses and how you monitor her blood glucose levels.
Yes, Olive uses a T-Slim pump, and it has the ability to predict her blood sugar levels, and so and it speaks to a continuous glucose monitor that she has on her arm. And so it tells us her blood sugar levels, or if she's going to drop low or if she's going too high, so that we can, you know, that we can be smart and proactive about managing her care.
And you mentioned
very independent with it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you mentioned she's independent, and that also you and your husband are getting notified. So this is interesting. We talk about advances in technology. This pump, you're able to get notified on your phones if her blood glucose level is too high or too low?
That's right. It connects to an application that we both have on our phones. And unfortunately, my daughter, Olive, has to have her phone. We wouldn't have given her a phone, but she has one, and it connects to our phone. So we're constantly able to monitor her blood sugar levels throughout the day. And we can connect with her to see what's going on. If there's something that doesn't look right, for the most part, we kind of keep it in the background and don't really bother her too much about it, but it's really comforting, especially as parents of a newly diagnosed child, to be able to monitor from anywhere while we're at work and she's at school. We that was a huge comfort for us.
And again, you mentioned this trial that allows Olive to have this insulin pump. If you were not involved in the trial, how would you then treat her diabetes? Would it be a manual injection?
It would be for a while, depending on insurance coverage of pumps. You know, that's not something that I have looked into. We were fortunate enough to be asked to be part of this trial at the beginning of Olive's diagnosis, which was one of the requirements of this trial. So we did do insulin injections with a pen for a few weeks. And I was thinking that was something that we would have to do for a few months until we were able to get a pump, which is something that Olive was very interested in.
Mm-hmm. Marie, earlier you mentioned the new normal. And so I'm wondering if you can talk through what you mean by that, in the sense of, you know, Olive is a very active child, I understand, plays several sports. And when you got this diagnosis and people around you found out that Olive now has diabetes, did you hear from more people in the community that actually I have someone in my family with diabetes? What was the feedback like from people that you know?
It was immediate, Lucy. It was all around us. People were showing up and sharing their stories of family members who have type 1 diabetes. Even our local pharmacists, both of his sons have type 1 diabetes. And I never knew. I've been living in this town for over 15 years. And, you know, stories of support and, you know, offers for help or any kind of resources that we needed. Some of my students and their parents came forward with support and help, and it was just amazing to see how many people around me were affected by type 1 diabetes. Mm.
Olive, I wanted to go back to you because you said now with the pump, things are great. And so I'm wondering if you can talk through how you're still doing many activities and sports, and also how you work with your mom when you think about making meal choices, like for lunch or dinner.
Well, we mostly go with the things that aren't with high sugar.
And so when you think about lunch, what's a typical lunch for that your mom will help make you, for you?
Well, like nuts, like a typical ham and cheese sandwich, pasta, things that are like low carb and stuff.
Marie, did you want to add to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, we do tend to stay away from high sugar foods. But we haven't really, and that's not something that we ate before her diagnosis. So we haven't really changed our eating habits at all. It's just the counting of carbs. Now I constantly read labels, see how many carbs are in any food that we make. If I make a big one pot dish, I have to weigh and divide the whole meal to see how many carbs are per serving. So it's a few extra steps. On the other hand, it's a great learning experience about, what we eat and how we eat. And all of this is a big part of the planning of her lunches and her breakfast. So that's nice that she's involved in her own meals. I label all the things that she has in her lunchbox with the number of carbs. So I'll just put a sticker and the number of carbs. So she puts that in at lunchtime in her pump. It's now it's just part of the routine. It used to be daunting, but now it's just something that we do pretty easily.
And Olive, I mentioned you play, I think, several sports. So lacrosse, and your mom told us that you started taekwondo and also basketball. But what's it like now in school? Do your friends understand that you have diabetes and you have to be careful about what you're eating and your activities at times?
Yeah.
And what are their questions?
They actually don't really mind my diabetes. They think it's like not really a big problem.
And so what do you want people to know that might have children who are like you that may have diabetes? What do you want them to know about how you and your family have approached this?
Don't really know.
Marie, did you want to add?
That life goes on, and that you move forward and you meet new people and you learn new information and you just discover another side of yourself that you didn't know existed. I think that's a pretty plain way to put it. It has transformed our whole family in a way that I never imagined, could be possible. Mm-hmm. In really good ways.
And what about the support that your family is receiving? Does Olive have someone to talk to besides her family members about this new diagnosis?
Yeah, Olive has a really awesome therapist that she speaks to every week and every Monday. Yeah, and she really enjoys having that outlet. And a lot of her medical team around her are people who not only are experts, but are also type 1 themselves. And they have just a personal connection and a special bond because of that.
Well, I want to thank you and Olive for coming on today to tell us a little bit about your family's story around type 1 diabetes. Olive, it was a pleasure to hear from you. Thank you for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much for having us on, Lucy.
That's Marie Snow and Olive Snow. They live in Killingworth, Connecticut. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we talk to a pediatric diabetes specialist about treatment options and learn the status of insulin caps in our state and on the federal level. Also, a member of the Connecticut chapter of JDRF, a global diabetes research funding organization, will join us. You can join us too. Do you have a family member with diabetes, or do you have questions about diabetes in young people? 888-720-9677. Or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Join Connecticut Public and Fairfield County's Community Foundation for the In-Community Speaker Series May 2nd, featuring New York Times Magazine journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project. Jones will talk about her work covering racial injustice and the legacy of slavery on our culture, our politics, and our institutions. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. at District Music Hall in Norwalk. Tickets at ctpublic.org/speaker-series. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. We just heard from a Connecticut mother and daughter about her daughter's recent type 1 diabetes diagnosis. About 1.6 million Americans have type 1 diabetes. This is where the immune system attacks the insulin-producing cells in the pancreas, leaving the body with little or no insulin. In type 2 diabetes, the pancreas is able to make insulin, but the body is insulin resistant. And both types of diabetes require patients to rely on insulin medication. Now, coming up, we're going to talk about disparities in the disease and what researchers know about the growing prevalence of type 1 diabetes in young people. I wanted to take a quick call. Representative Brandon McGee is calling in from Hartford. Hello, Representative McGee. Can you hear us? Oh, it looks like he was on hold for too long. Maybe he wants to call back. Again, the number to join us, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us now on Zoom is Dr. Jennifer Scher. She's Associate Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at Yale School of Medicine and a pediatric endocrinologist at Yale Medicine. Dr. Scher, welcome to our show.
Thanks so much, Lucy. Happy to be here.
I wanted to ask you first about this CDC report that shows that type 1 diabetes is growing sharply in African-American and Hispanic youth populations. That's between 2002 and 2015. Also, type 1 cases among African-American children and Hispanic children increasing by 20% compared to 14% among white children. And the reasons behind this, no one really knows why. So I'm wondering if you can talk through what you're seeing as a pediatric endocrinologist.
Yeah, so I think you make great points there. You know, we definitely are seeing increased prevalence of type 1 diabetes. But in terms of the factors that are implicated in it, you know, much remains unknown. We know that this is a polygenic condition, meaning that there is genetic factors along with environmental risks, but we continue to learn more about what leads someone to develop type 1 diabetes. Now we can actually see in those at high risk due to a family member with type 1, whether or not somebody has something called an autoantibody that can indicate that that person is at higher risk to go on and develop type 1. So we definitely know that we're seeing increased numbers, but I think we still have to do a lot of research as to why and what we can do to stop this whole development.
I understand you're involved at Yale with TrialNet. That's the consortium involved in cutting-edge research to prevent type 1 diabetes, also to slow the progression for people that have this diagnosis already. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so I think that the work with TrialNet is really intriguing. What that consortium has been doing for over 15 years is looking at how do we predict who's going to go on and develop diabetes. So you can take individuals who have either a first or second degree relative with type 1 diabetes, and you can send autoantibodies. And what we know is if somebody has one or more autoantibodies that we can measure, we understand that they're 2-year or their 5-year risk to going on and developing type 1 diabetes is going to be 35 to 50% of that population. In addition to that, if somebody has one or more antibodies and also shows some signs of higher glucose levels, their 2-year risk of developing type 1 diabetes is 60%, and their 5-year risk is 80%. So these individuals who show these biomarkers, we know they're going to develop the condition. It's just a matter of when. And we're now seeking a number of therapies to go ahead and stop that progression from these biomarkers being present to actually requiring insulin therapy.
Let's talk more about these therapies, as you mentioned. We're talking to you on the 100th anniversary this month of the discovery of insulin. And I had said earlier, when people have either type 1 or type 2, the treatment is insulin, whether daily injections or having certain pumps that can input this as well. So I'm just wondering if you can talk through, when we think about how insulin helps diabetics and what they're seeing in terms of their blood glucose control levels.
Yeah, and so I think it's important to just look back in terms of where we've come from to understand how far we've gotten with technological advancements. So, you know, back in 1979, we first published on insulin pump therapy and the ability to wear this huge blue brick that provided more physiologic insulin delivery. And it was led by Dr. William Tamberlane, who's the chief of pediatric endocrinology here at Yale. Over the years, we've then seen the development of continuous glucose monitors, which your prior guests were speaking about. And that allows us to view real-time data of glucose levels. So instead of seeing 4 points per day, we're now seeing 288 readings a day. I always tell families when I talk about this technology, it's like Dorothy going from Kansas and showing up in Oz and seeing Technicolor. All of a sudden, things have dimension and you can understand what's happening with your body. Now, layer upon that the ability to have these pumps and these sensors communicate with each other and adjust some of the background insulin needs. And we've been involved in those studies for years upon years, with the first commercial system hitting the market in 2016. And while that system was great, it had a lot of areas that could require improvement. And so our group has actively been working on these new technologies that the goal is to more closely match physiologic insulin needs and reduce the burden to somebody living with type 1. So things will be adjusted more on their own. And ultimately, the goal is to have what we would call a full closed loop system, where a user could just wear the devices and not even need to put any inputs to go ahead and indicate, hey, I'm eating or I'm going to be doing activity, things that are still required today. And I do want to recognize, because I know JDRF is on, that they have been instrumental in the development of each of these components and continue the progression to see us really change how we care for diabetes.
Before we hear from JDRF, I'm wondering if you can talk about some of the other advances. We heard earlier the Olive, who uses a type of pump, and they have to change the area of injection and make sure they watch for infection. But there's also something called an Omnipod, which is a tubeless insulin pump. But can you talk about that? And, you know, when we think about access to care, I mean, how many people can have one of these, Dr. Scher?
Yeah, so there's lots of different pumps out there. The Omnipod is a pump that is tubeless, and we're currently working on the studies to allow for an automated insulin delivery system similar to what your prior guest had, where the sensor and the pump are speaking to each other. And in terms of, you know, what we would like as a provider, and I think that the whole sentiment of our group is that everybody should be afforded the most advanced technology that they would like to use. And so with that, I think our goal is to make sure we speak about technologies, we educate families and help them along the path of what's available. And for years, you know, it had previously been talked about, well, who can have these technologies? And older consensus guidelines would say, well, the ideal candidate is. And more recently, this past May, I co-chaired the American Association of Clinical Endocrinology's updates on advanced diabetes technology. And what we said is there's no ideal candidate. A person with diabetes who is insulin requiring deserves access to this technology. And so we're really, you know, going ahead and trying to push the limits to say it's not a specific type or set of characteristics. The characteristic is I'm insulin requiring. I deserve these technologies. They will improve my glycemia. They will improve my life. And my role is to talk to my patients about it and then really fight with insurance companies to get coverage.
And that was my next question, Dr. Scher, the fight with insurance companies to get coverage. And so what is typically approved for someone who has private insurance? Or does it just depend on the plan? If someone like a child has diabetes, how quickly can a family be able to maybe have the pump to help with their blood glucose levels?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so it varies so much plan to plan. I will say we are pretty successful with kids. So I have youth who are diagnosed and within a month, I have them on an insulin pump. In other situations, we have some antiquated policies with some of these insurers that state that you need to have diabetes for 6 months before we would approve this technology. And I've written some strongly worded letters, and I've also had some very frank conversations, you know, reminding these insurance companies that this is a chronic medical condition. It's not going to change 6 months from now. And all we're doing is making it harder as a child and a family adjust to a new diagnosis. And I think through advocacy work done both by persons with diabetes, providers, and then advocacy groups like JDRF and ADA, I'm very hopeful we can change the mindset and recognize that everybody deserves access to this technology.
You're hearing on Zoom here on Where We Live, Dr. Jennifer Scher, Associate Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at Yale School of Medicine. She's a pediatric endocrinologist at Yale Medicine. As we talk about type 1 diabetes, also type 2 diabetes among young people, you can join us 888-720-9677 or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We've mentioned JDRF. Joining us now is John Muskrat, Executive Director of the Connecticut and Western Massachusetts Chapter of JDRF. This is an organization that really leads when it comes to funding research for type 1 diabetes. John, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Lucy. Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about JDRF's role in access to care when we think about just the technologies that are now available to help families of people that have diabetes have good outcomes.
Right. So JDRF is really involved sort of in every aspect along the pipeline for those technologies. We fund a lot of the basic research at places like Yale and other institutions around the world. We work with insurance providers. We work with regulators, you know, really kind of measuring success that the technologies that we're talking about need to be accessible into the hands of patients to impact their lives. So as an organization, we're really involved in every step along that pipeline.
And so talk with us about some of the policy also that has been passed that help patients, handle the high costs of their care and treatment for diabetes. What's happening in Connecticut on the federal level?
Sure. Insulin pricing, the cost of insulin has skyrocketed, and it is really just an incredibly critical issue facing the diabetes community. In JDRF, obviously, we really believe that insulin should be available at reasonable, predictable, out-of-pocket costs. Here in Connecticut, the state passed a $25 per 30-day supply cap for those who are on state-regulated commercial health insurance. That'll take effect in January. They also included in that bill capping supplies at $100 per 30-day supply. So Connecticut really is playing a leading role in that cost control of insulin. On the federal level, recently we were encouraged that Congress has included a $35 per month out-of-pocket cost cap on insulin in the Build Back Better bill that's working its way through Congress right now. So, and that would really represent a substantial savings for people with diabetes and one of the most significant steps taken by the federal government to date to lower the cost of insulin.
Well, that's good to hear. Earlier, I had talked to Dr. Scherr about, the rates overall of type 1 and type 2 diabetes going up among youth under 20. And so what can you tell us from JDRF's perspective of, this troubling numbers and also, just how outreach and awareness is important here?
Absolutely. I think outreach to that newly diagnosed community is critical, certainly during the pandemic when everything was virtual and, we missed out on a lot of those in-person connections, whether they're support groups and meetups, it became even more of a challenge. But, nearly 1.6 million Americans have type 1 diabetes right now. That's up about 30% from 2017. And as you mentioned earlier, especially among youth, it's increased in about 20% for African-American children and Hispanic children as well. So, as an organization, sort of our support outreach efforts, have really intensified trying to engage those communities, bring them into feel the support of the network, and also give them access to resources and other things that can help managing this disease a little bit easier for them.
You can join our conversation as we talk about diabetes among children and young people. The number 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Representative McGee, I think, is calling now. Representative McGee, can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear, Lucy. Can you hear me?
Yes, wonderful. Thank you for calling back. What did you want to share?
Yeah, no, first of all, Lucy, thank you so much for all the great work that you do. And today is especially special to me in that your first two guests really just hit home. As a person who was diagnosed with diabetes a little over 7 years ago, type 2 diabetes, it took me a little while to accept the fact that I was a diabetic and I had to embrace a new normalcy. And if Molly is still listening, I want her to know that even adults still struggle with, trying to manage your glucose readings and better understand this disease or what have you. And for me, I am just so thankful that we were able to, as my niece would say, catch it before it caught me. I was hospitalized for about 2 weeks. And this was, again, 7 years ago, and I've since been able to adjust and change my diet. I'm now a vegan and, still struggling in ways that I am sharing with people more as I get older in hopes to help people be okay with what you have, but understanding your numbers. It's very, very important. So again, thank you, Lucy, for all of the experts that you have on. Thank you for this information, and I'll continue to listen in.
Well, thank you for calling in, Representative McGee, and sharing part of your story. Before you go, though, I have to ask, because you also are a law state lawmaker doing work on behalf of your constituents. We just heard John Muskrat talk about Connecticut mandating insurance coverage for diabetes, also an insulin pricing bill that will take effect in January of 2022, which is going to limit insulin copayments to $25. That's huge for people. And I'm wondering, when you think about the community you represent, centers and other ways that the state can help people with this diabetes diagnosis?
Yeah, you know, and I appreciate that question. I am very pleased to say that the state of Connecticut, I believe we're moving toward the right direction when you begin talking about access to health care for all people, especially our most vulnerable populations. The people I represent could benefit a great deal with this new mandate. Frankly, it should be free, if you ask me. I am in a very privileged space in that I have state insurance, right? And with state insurance, I'm pretty much covered. But there are others who suffer from type 1, type 2 diabetes, and unfortunately, they don't have that same privilege or access. And so I think we're moving toward the right direction, but we need to take it a step further and providing access to the proper care, education and awareness, but most importantly, the medicine, insulin, that's needed to help bring or stabilize, you know, your glucose numbers, your A1C, et cetera. But one of your speakers spoke a lot about the disparities that exist, and it's true. In some communities, they're, you know, we're struggling a great deal. And so my goal, my mission is to continue telling my personal story in hopes that people will take this a bit more seriously. And it's a silent killer. I think your first guest, they talked about it. It's not something that you always see. You feel it and you experience it, especially in men of color, but you don't necessarily understand it. And oftentimes you tend to try to avoid those signs that your body is telling you something is wrong. Yeah, I mean, I can talk on and on about it just from a personal experience. But again, I can't thank you enough, Lucy, and all your guests.
Well, thank you, State Representative Brandon McGee, for calling in to the show. Before I take another caller, David, stay with us. I just wanted to have Dr. Jennifer Scher respond to what Representative McGee shared about even his personal story with diabetes.
No, I'm going to just share myself. So I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 1987, and I couldn't agree with you more that with the appropriate medications and access to therapy, we can all do really well. I've lived with diabetes for 34 years. I was on purified pork insulin in 1987. That's all that was available. Mm-hmm. And I've been amazed to watch the drastic improvements in the care that we can receive and how it's impacted my life. And not just my life, but the life of my kids, who say I'm nicer when my glucose levels are more in range, and my ability to concentrate and do my job. And so I think that what his point, that we have to just make sure that everybody is getting access and the ability to use the amazing medical products that have been developed, because we can make it so that diabetes can fade a little bit more into the background. It's always going to be there. It's going to be a chronic condition. But I am living with diabetes. I am not a diabetic. I just happen to have this thing that I have to take care of, but I have the fortune of the tools needed, and I want to ensure everybody has that.
Thank you, Jennifer Scher, again, pediatric diabetes specialist at Yale Medicine and also associate professor. I wanted to take another call. David's calling in from Cheshire. David, go ahead.
Good morning, Lucy, and good morning to all your guests. I practiced internal medicine and primarily gastroenterology in the Cheshire Wallingford Meriden vicinity for the past 40 years. And I get to see the consequences of diabetes that's been neglected, primarily type 1. Not being an endocrinologist, I don't see a lot of type 1. I see type 2 primarily. I misspoke there. And the consequences are things that patients don't even really appreciate as such. The coronary artery disease, they hear about their kidneys, they hear about their eyes. They don't appreciate the vascular complications. And because these things are asymptomatic, you've heard the term silent killer already, they tend to be neglected. What's so short-sighted on the part of the insurance companies is that they're the ones that are going to be paying for these consequences over the long run. And because they don't really have a longitudinal commitment to patients, they don't have any consequences themselves. The other point I wanted to make is that the socioeconomic barriers are huge. Everybody's a candidate, but there are so many socioeconomic barriers, especially among the older population, among more disadvantaged groups, that even with the benefit of some of these remarkable advancements, there are so many people that can't take advantage of them. I have a third observation, but I'd be curious to hear what your guests have to say about those.
Yes, thank you, David. Dr. Scher, we touched on this earlier, but did you want to respond to David?
So I think David made a number of great points, and I'm grateful for the care that you provide to your patients. I think that we are rewriting how diabetes, type 2 diabetes particularly, is being managed. Previously, it had been with primarily insulin therapy, but over the years, we've seen new classes of medication come on board, including sodium glucose cotransporter inhibitors and glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonists. And these therapies have now been found to, in individuals with type 2 diabetes, protect the kidneys and the heart and reduce risk of cardiovascular mortality and also of renal outcomes. And so I agree, we need to be talking about these complications and we need to use the right therapies and we need to make sure that we are telling patients about these options. And we have seen in the American Diabetes Association, the recommendations of how we care for individuals change drastically. And so I am truly hopeful, the same way we have seen type 1 diabetes change in the past 20 years due to the treatments that are available, we will see the same hold true for type 2 diabetes. But again, it's through that change in consensus guidelines, you know, reports from groups highlighting that this in the end is economically beneficial to the healthcare system. But in my view, most importantly, the person with diabetes living with it. So I think we're at the precipice of seeing dramatic changes occur.
You've been hearing Dr. Jennifer Scher, Associate Professor of Pediatric Endocrinology at Yale School of Medicine, also a pediatric endocrinologist at Yale Medicine. Thank you for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Lucy.
This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up, we're going to talk more about the disparities in access to care for people of color who have diabetes. You can join us as well. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live on Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today we're talking about diabetes in youth. Disparities in blood glucose outcomes among ethnic and racial minorities persist, as reported in the Type 1 Diabetes Exchange Research Registry and also SEARCH study cohorts. And Where We Live obtained data from Connecticut Medicaid. To date, the Husky Health Medicaid program covers more than 408,000 children below the age of 20. That's this year. And this includes 1,156 children and youth for type 1 diabetes and 928 for type 2. So what are some factors behind the numbers? Joining us now is Mark Abraham, Executive Director of Data Haven. Mark, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lucy.
So when we think about disparities, and we heard earlier from Representative McGee, cost of care being one of them, I wanted to talk more about the survey that Data Haven did, a well-being survey. When we think about type 2 diabetes that can be delayed or prevented through exercise and healthy eating, but that also means access to healthy food. And so looking at the survey, what does this look like in lower income communities like Hartford, New Haven, and Bridgeport?
Yeah, good question. Before I get into the data, I just want to mention, you have to consider the resourcefulness of families when they're looking for food. So you think if families are paying 80% of their income towards rent, which is common, how do they find food? Also, I think of an example of a 16-year-old who works after school until midnight to support their family with rent. And it's just too late to come home at midnight and cook dinner when, you know, several people are sleeping in their living room and kitchen. So they find that the one fast food restaurant that's open, and you have to think about this sort of work that people do to eat health, to eat food. And, you know, before you necessarily think of like whether they have access to healthy food or not, just thinking of the resilience that families have and thinking of those ways that we could improve health. But when we look at the data, we definitely see disparities. I mean, the clearest, the other callers mentioned socioeconomic disparities and places, both matter. So places like our city centers, in some cases, you see 10 times higher rates of diabetes-related amputation, which is sort of like one of the worst outcomes of diabetes. And that could be traced back to both the higher risks of those areas and income and things like that, but also barriers to healthcare. On the environmental challenges, though, some of the ones that we see in our survey include higher concerns about gun violence. In the 2021 survey we're working on now, we found 52% of Hartford residents are concerned that someone in their family will be injured by gun violence, and 14% have actually just witnessed a shooting within the past 12 months in Hartford. And that's, you know, that could be 10 times or 20 times higher than the rates in the rest of Connecticut. So things like gun violence, obviously we could talk about access to parks and recreational areas and just access to food in general, which is, you know, closely linked to like not having a car, not having supermarkets in your neighborhood.
Let's talk about access to the outdoors in this well-being survey by Data Haven. 13% of residents in Connecticut city centers, compared to 46% in the suburbs, felt that parks and recreational facilities in their area were excellent. And so can we talk about that, that lack of access to recreational spaces like parks and how that impacts children?
Right. Yeah. If you're in an area where it's difficult to walk places, it could be due to the hills, like in places like Waterbury, very steep hills. It could be the parks are in poor condition. Even if you have parks in your area, it doesn't mean that your parents will, you know, are comfortable letting you access those due to the other concerns I mentioned. So those are major challenges. And if you look at the disparities between places like Waterbury and Hartford and the wealthy suburbs, they're just much more extreme than you see with, you know, other kind of disparities we think about in the state. So it does call for, you know, attention to the built environment. There is research showing, you know, improving the built environment makes people more comfortable going outside and meeting neighbors and exercising.
What do we know about patient navigators that are in communities to even talk about diabetes risk and awareness? What do we know, Mark?
Yeah, so there are large disparities in access to care. And, you know, I think some of the other callers talked about that. But one is that is important is lack of health insurance. And, you know, if we look at who doesn't have health insurance and then who's not being, say, vaccinated for COVID or visiting doctors or accessing telehealth, there's a clear connection there. So you would imagine that, you know, parents and families that don't have good health insurance or don't have health insurance at all in many cases are just not able to access the types of preventive treatment that would, you know, reduce the risks of diabetes or prevent it from happening in the first place.
John Muskrat is still with us, executive director of the JDRF. Again, this is the local Connecticut and Western Massachusetts chapter. John, do you have anything to add to that question when you think about raising awareness and access to care in communities where there are disparities?
Yeah, I think one other important point, kind of connected to what some of the earlier guests talked about, is access to clinical trials. Participating in a clinical trial is a lot of people's way to be able to benefit from some of the latest technology or that might be out there. But too often, clinical trials have lacked diversity. So, you know, we've worked to develop a clinical trial locator, a simple tool on our website where anyone can find a clinical trial in their area they can participate in. And also have kind of built out a volunteer network throughout our chapters to try to encourage participation in clinical trials as a way to drive access to some of the latest care technology that might be out there.
Earlier, I asked Dr. Scher about technology that can help improve compliance to keep these blood glucose levels in a normal range and help people. When we think about Connecticut Medicaid, you know, do we know if it covers this kind of technology like the Omnipod, for instance, John?
Yes, Medicare programs do cover CGMs that they, you know, the data is very clear in sort of their benefit in managing type 1. So those insurance programs have covered them.
And then we think about some other ways to bridge the gaps to access, John, some last words on that as we look at what's happening here in our state.
Yeah, I think, you know, kind of in closing or summary, I think, you know, as from your previous guests have said, the access, the care, the technology, and the treatments and therapies that are there to manage type 1 diabetes have really made huge advances. But without access to those, people aren't benefiting. So, you know, our mission is really to try to bring those awareness, bring those resources to these communities to make sure they're aware of them, while at the same time advocating both state and federally for better insurance coverage, better options, cost options for people with no insurance or under insurance, so they can benefit from some of these technologies that have really revolutionized the way diabetes can be managed.
We're almost out of time. I just wanted to bring up someone called in earlier, someone who has type 1 diabetes, talking about the insulin prices that have skyrocketed in this country. A lot of frustration with insurance companies, but also drug manufacturers, John, and the prices that they set for something like insulin. That sounds like a whole nother show, but an important point to mention when you think about what insulin costs in other countries, John.
Right. Yeah. And just, you know, an additional point on that, it's more than just insulin pricing as well. It's the supplies that go along with it. And I hear from plenty of people who have great commercial insurance or private insurance who are still paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month for supplies that go along with their care. So it is a complex issue, but one that, you know, we're committed to. I agree with your previous guest. Insulin is a basic right for people that need it to live, and it should be affordable and accessible to all.
That's John Muskrat, Executive Director of the JDRF Local Chapter. Thank you, John. Also, Mark Abraham was here, Executive Director of Data Haven. We'll be sure to tweet out links to Data Haven's well-being survey. That's at Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Today's show produced by Sujata Srinivasan. We'll be back tomorrow.